I want to start with a question.
Yeah.
You know, about memory and identity. If you go through something incredibly intense,
right,
like, say, a military deployment or a really rigorous grad program, or in this case, a 2-year religious mission, and then it just ends, what happens to that version of you?
Does it just get put on a shelf?
Yeah. Does it get archived in a photo album? Or does it actually, you know, rewrite your operating system for the next 50 years?
That is the classic life-defining chapter dilemma. And usually we only have anecdotes to answer that. We have memories, maybe some nostalgia.
But not data.
But not data. And what we're looking at today is something, well, it's pretty rare. It's essentially a longitudinal data set.
This is based on the document 22 after the mission.
Correct. It's a compilation of accounts from a specific cohort of missionaries. They all served in Finland in the early 1970s under a mission president named Robert Waite.
But I want to be clear. This isn't just a where are they now newsletter.
No, not at all. It tracks the long tail of that service.
Yeah.
We aren't just looking at 1974. We're looking at how those specific 24 months impacted their career choices, their families,
their whole lives,
their resilience 5 decades later.
I have to admit, I went into this expecting the usual reunion stories. You know, remember that time we got lost in the snow, or remember how bad the food was?
And there is some of that.
There is, but the data points here are so much stranger. I mean, we're talking encounters with Vietnam POWs, grandmothers working in medium security prisons,
and statisticians using algorithms to defend scripture. It all really centers around this Finnish concept of sisu.
Which translates to what exactly? I've seen it on bumper stickers, but what does it mean in this context?
It's notoriously hard to translate, but think of it as white knuckle grit.
Okay.
It's this quiet dignity and determination in the face of, you know, zero odds. And the argument here is that these missionaries learned sisu in the 70s, trudging through those dark winters, and then applied it in really unexpected ways later in life.
Okay, let's test that theory. Because the document starts right with that transition home. It's August 1973. You have these missionaries leaving Finland. They're feeling good. They've done their time. They've graduated.
And then reality hits them in the face at the Frankfurt airport.
Right.
This is the story of Vaughn Armstrong. He's stuck on a 14-hour layover. He and his companion are just sitting here, probably feeling pretty accomplished.
I mean, they've sacrificed 2 years.
They've worked hard. And then they strike up a conversation with the Jensen family.
And this isn't just any tourist family on vacation. The father is Lieutenant Colonel J.R. Jensen.
A name that just stops you in your tracks if you know your Vietnam War history. Jensen had been a prisoner of war.
For how long?
6 years. He had been released from the Hanoi Hilton just 6 months prior in February 1973.
So paint that picture, the contrast. You have a 21-year-old who voluntarily gave 2 years of his life. And he's sitting across from a man who involuntarily lost 6 years of his in brutal captivity.
It just completely reframed the whole experience for Armstrong. He's listening to Colonel Jensen talk about his time in the camps. Jensen mentions that to stay sane, the prisoners would teach each other classes, math, biology, whatever they knew.
Uh-huh.
And Jensen taught the gospel.
Wait, how? He wouldn't have had a Bible or any books in a POW camp?
From memory, zero resources. No scriptures, no manuals. He told Armstrong he was just amazed at how much he had retained things he didn't even know he had memorized.
Wow.
It was this testament to the idea that if you put the information in your mind, the spirit can access it later.
That's incredible. But there's also this weirdly grounding detail in the story. Didn't they go on some kind of treasure hunt during the layover?
They did.
Yeah.
It adds so much color to the story. The Jensen family was using some of the colonel's back pay to take a trip, and they were trying to find a ceremonial sword he'd left at an officer's club in Wiesbaden years before.
So you have these missionaries, who probably haven't spent a dime on anything extra in 2 years, suddenly taking a taxi with a former POW to find a sword.
And the taxi driver is lecturing them about the soil quality for wine grapes.
Oh, that's perfect.
They're just nodding politely, but their minds are completely blown. But think about the psychological impact on that young missionary.
Yeah.
Armstrong is going home thinking, I've done my bit. And he meets a man who maintained his faith in solitary confinement. It seems like it just stripped away any sense of entitlement about his service.
It's a huge reality check. It wasn't mission accomplished. It was realizing his service was just the training wheels.
Exactly. The real test of faith like Jensen's might come later. It grounded him. It suggested the mission wasn't the peak, but the foundation.
And that theme, that the mission is just the training wheels, it plays out for this whole group. The document says this Wade-era cohort went on to serve 29 senior missions.
29. It's a high number. But when we say senior missions, I think a lot of people picture, you know, a nice couple working in a visitor center or maybe genealogy office.
Right, something quiet.
And many do. But this group seems to attract the, let's say, unconventional assignments.
Like Darwin and Debbie Rasmussen.
Oh, yeah.
This was the story that made me laugh out loud. Darwin says they submitted their papers expecting something pretty standard, maybe a bishop's storehouse.
Scanning barcodes on cans of peaches.
Exactly. And the letter comes back.
Medium security women's prison.
His reaction is perfect. He calls it medium unexpected.
But look at how they handled it. This is where that adaptability that Sisu comes in. They didn't panic. Darwin, he self-appoints himself the music department.
Which, in reality, meant what?
It meant he was in charge of a scratched CD player.
It's humbling, isn't it? You're a professional with a lifetime of experience, and your job is to press play on a boombox for 200 Sundays.
But that humility allowed his wife, Debbie, to really shine. She became the teacher. And the dynamic in that prison changed. At first, they were dealing with church members who'd gotten into trouble.
Uh-huh.
But over time, the congregation shifted to mostly non-members. One inmate actually told them, "You two are way too cheerful for a Sunday night in prison. I had to see what drugs you were on."
That's amazing. And it's fascinating that Darwin said he saw Sisu in the inmates, but also in his wife. I mean, she had to learn to teach in a place where the spirit had to get through metal detectors and concrete walls.
It's a totally different skill set than knocking on doors in Helsinki. It requires a different level of empathy, a total lack of judgment. You can't preach at people there. You have to be with them.
And speaking of different skill sets, let's talk about the Gallups. Because if the Rasmussens were dealing with physical confinement, Tom and Johan Gallup were dealing with the digital expanse.
This is a great example of just scale. Mm. They helped run the Virtual Records Operations Center. We're talking about managing a workforce that grew from 725 people.
To 1,400.
To 1,400 people.
Hold on, 1,400 missionaries. That's bigger than most actual missions. That's the size of a corporation.
It is massive. And you have to understand what they're doing. This isn't just filing papers. It's cloud computing, verifying records from all over the world, managing remote teams across time zones.
And remember, these are retirees. They served in Finland in the 70s using, like, flannel boards and printed tracks.
Right. No internet, no cell phones. And now, in their 60s and 70s, they're managing a virtual army with cloud tech. It just shatters the stereotype that the older generation can't adapt to technology.
If the mission is important enough, they figure it out.
They learn how to lead in Finland, and they just updated the tools.
Adaptability really seems to be the key for this group, especially when they tried to go back to Finland. The section on Scott and Paula Perkins reads like a suspense thriller.
The visa saga.
Right. So they feel this pull to serve in Finland again, but the government changed the visa wording. Suddenly, senior couples are getting rejected left and right.
And their own mission president tells them, look, if we can't get you in, the church is probably going to stop calling seniors to Finland entirely.
The stakes were huge. It wasn't just about their mission. It was about the whole pipeline. Logically, they should have quit.
But they submitted the papers anyway. And their stake president, their local leader, even called them the Friday before they were supposed to leave for training.
And asked what?
Are you sure you want to do this? The missionary department says you likely won't get in. You're going to get turned around at the border.
And they went anyway. They just showed up for training on pure faith.
And it paid off. 3 weeks later, the visas miraculously appeared. They were the exception. But, and this is the key, getting into the country was just the first hurdle. They arrived, started working, and then it was March 2020.
COVID, the world just shuts down.
The evacuation order drops from church headquarters. Everyone go home. The Perkins described going into a stupor of thought. They were paralyzed.
They couldn't even pack.
They couldn't pack their suitcases because it felt so wrong to leave after fighting so hard to get there.
But then a loophole appears. The area presidency allowed one senior couple to stay in each mission just to keep the lights on.
And the Perkins volunteered immediately. For 3 months, they were the only adults in the room. They were moving young missionaries out of apartments, driving vans, dealing with landlords.
But because they stayed, they were able to facilitate this massive structural change.
The international wars.
Exactly.
Because of gathering restrictions, they couldn't meet in large groups. So they had to restructure how the English-speaking members met, and they consolidated them. This paved the way for a permanent international ward in Helsinki. And they used Zoom to form the Jyväskylä stake.
Which covers what, two-thirds of the entire country?
Geographically, yes. And creating a new stake that's a major organizational unit like a diocese usually takes years of planning. They did it out of necessity during a pandemic because they were on the ground.
It's a total sliding doors moment. If they had listened to the logic back in the U.S., don't bother with the visa, none of that infrastructure would exist today.
Their stubbornness, or sisu, directly shaped the future map of the church in Finland.
It's not always about brute force, though. Sometimes that long tail of the mission shows up as just clever strategy. I was fascinated by Darwin Rasmussen again, acting as a ward mission leader back home.
The Special Book of Mormon. This is brilliant behavioral psychology, even if he didn't call it that.
So explain the setup, because usually when a leader asks members to find people to teach, everyone just freezes up. It feels like high-pressure sales.
Right. The cortisol spikes, and your brain just goes into avoidance mode. So Darwin flips the script. He brings a specific copy of the Book of Mormon to a family. He sets it on the table like it's a fragile artifact, and he asks them, will you pray to find someone to give this to?
Within the next 2 years.
2 years. It sounds completely counterintuitive. Usually goals are by next week.
But that's the genius of it.
It is. Mm-hmm. By setting the deadline so far out, he removes all the immediate anxiety. The fight or flight response just turns off. The members think, oh, 2 years. I can do that. No pressure.
So what happens to their awareness?
It creates a psychological thing called a frequency illusion. Once they stop worrying about selling, they just start noticing opportunities. And within a month, he had families finding people.
So by giving them a long runway, he actually helped them take off immediately.
Exactly. Then you have the academic application. We have to talk about Bruce Scholja. He took his mission language and combined it with his career in statistics.
Okay, this part was a bit dense. He's doing stylometric analysis. What does that actually mean?
Think of it as fingerprinting, a text using math. Every author has a unique statistical signature, how often they use and, the, but sentence lengths.
Okay.
Scholja has published papers analyzing the Book of Mormon using these high-level stats.
So he's using math to defend the book against critics who claim Joseph Smith wrote it.
Essentially, yes. He's using his professional expertise to rebut attacks on the text's authorship. It's a perfect example of how missionary work evolves. Sometimes it's knocking on a door in the snow.
And sometimes it's publishing a peer-reviewed paper.
He's still defending the faith, just with algorithms instead of pamphlets.
And sometimes it's just showing off at the Olympics.
The language in the wild stories. These are great.
Scholja, again, he's on a plane after the 2002 Salt Lake Olympics. He hears Finnish in the row behind him. It's a group of ski jumpers.
And instead of just nodding or saying moi, he turns around and drops his exact street address from his time in Rovaniemi. Unasaviran Tai.
Just like that.
He said he didn't even know he remembered it. It just fired out of his neural pathways.
It's deep storage. It's like muscle memory. And then there's Dennis Dowdle doing the same thing with the Finnish bobsled team in Park City.
It just disarms people. When an American suddenly speaks fluent, colloquial Finnish, barriers dissolve. It creates an instant bond.
And that bond is hereditary. That's the other major insight from these documents. The mission didn't end with them. It passed to their kids.
The numbers are pretty significant. And we're not just talking about a family culture of service. We have hard numbers. 86 missions served by the children of this group and 39 by the grandchildren.
And you see lineages returning to Finland. Heikki Rinne's son and grandson both went back to the same mission field. But the story that really lands this point, the one that feels almost cinematic, is Marcus Hutchins at the Boston Temple.
This one gave me chills.
Yeah.
So Marcus is serving in the temple presidency, a senior leadership role. It's October 2022. A young woman comes in to be set apart as an ordinance worker.
A volunteer who helps with the ceremonies inside.
Right. Her name is Bren. She's a musician studying flute performance. Marcus plays woodwinds, so they start chatting about music. Then she mentions she served her mission in Finland.
So Marcus speaks a little Finnish to her. The connection is made. And then she drops the bomb about who her family is.
She is the granddaughter of Robert Wade.
Wow.
Marcus's own mission president from 1973.
President Wade had passed away just a year before, and Bryn barely knew him. But here is Marcus, one of the young men her grandfather mentored 50 years ago, now acting as her mentor.
It didn't stop there. A year later, Bryn gets married. She asks Marcus to perform the sealing.
The marriage ceremony in the temple, the one that binds a family for eternity.
The most sacred ordinance they perform. Marcus described that day as a great day of gathering. He said the veil felt thin. He felt the presence of President Wade there watching his former missionary marry his granddaughter.
He called it fruit plucked from a tree planted in Finland nearly a half century ago.
That's the core message, isn't it? You plant a tree in 1973, you have no idea who is going to sit in the shade of it in 2023. It might be your own granddaughter being mentored by someone you taught to tie a tie 50 years ago.
It all circles back. There's another connection, too. Forrest and Nancy Modishaw, they were serving in Ohio at the historic church sites.
Right, near Kirtland. Deep church history territory. And they discover that just 13 miles away, in a place called Fairport Harbor, there was a historic Finnish settlement. It turns out many early saints and Finnish immigrants passed through that exact spot.
So even in Ohio, the Finnish connection just followed them.
It's a reminder that these connections between people and places often go back further than we realize.
So when we look at this whole longitudinal study, from the POW on the tarmac, to the prison, the visa miracles, the temple weddings, what's the synthesis? What does this tell us?
I think Earl Price, one of the missionaries in the document, summed it up best with his 50-miler analogy.
Yeah.
He compares the mission, and really any hard phase of life, to a grueling 50-mile scout hike.
I love this breakdown. It felt very real.
Phase one, survival. You're just trying not to die. Your feet hurt. Your pack is heavy. You're questioning all your life choices.
In there.
Phase two, PTA.
Pain, torture, agony.
Exactly. We've all been in the PTA phase. But then if you keep walking, you get to trucking along. And finally, you reach joy and bliss.
And the insight is
that when you look back 50 years later, the PTA phase fades. The memory edits out the agony. What remains is the joy and bliss. You realize the struggle was just the price of admission for the growth.
And that shared struggle creates a language. These people, 50 years on, they're still speaking it. They're still resilient. They're still missionaries, whether they're in a prison or a statistical lab.
It challenges you, I think. What is your 50-miler? What is the hard thing you're doing right now? Because if you're in that pain, torture, agony phase, statistically speaking, the joy and bliss is coming. You just have to wait for the long tail.
And who knows? 50 years from now, that struggle might be the foundation for your granddaughter's success. That is a powerful place to leave it. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us.
Not a way.